if you put your mind to something and you set aside the time and you put in the hard work, you can really control that outcome. And I think that in the toughest situations is something that I can go back to, whether it's professional, whether it's personal, whether it's family or whatever else, that gives hope. If you kind of put everything in, then you should have a really good shot at getting what you want out of it.
Welcome to Brave. Learn from Southeast Asia's best tech leaders. Build the future, learn from our past, and stay human in between. No BS on success. I'm Jeremy Au, venture capitalist, serial founder, Harvard MBA, science fiction nerd, and dad of two daughters. Every week, we debate startup news, interview changemakers, answer listener questions, and share personal insights. Join our movement of over 40,000 members and get transcripts, resources, and community at www.bravesea.com. Stay well and stay brave. HD Mall is a healthcare marketplace in Southeast Asia connecting patients to over 1,800 medical providers. This covers multiple categories such as dental, aesthetics, and elective surgeries. Over 300,000 patients have accessed more affordable healthcare via HD Mall. Get yourself a well-deserved health checkup. If you're in Thailand, go to hdmall.co.th. If you're in Indonesia, go to hdmall.id. Hey, Adrian, really excited to have you on the show.
Thanks, Jeremy. Likewise. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, it's been a long time coming. And, you know, you're such a fascinating journey that I really wanted to double click into that personal experience of yours. Could you share a little bit about yourself?
Sure. So I'm Adrian. Actually, I was originally born in the UK, in London, but my father comes from Hong Kong and my mother's from Malaysia. So I've had quite a culturally diverse upbringing. I've studied in the US for my MBA. I've lived in China, was an entrepreneur there. Also lived almost 10 years in Indonesia and also now split my time between Singapore and Indonesia as well. So I think having that quite diverse background and interfacing with people, Asian and Western, has really helped me do what I'm doing today. But excited to share more today. Thanks, Jeremy.
So what were you like in undergrad? What career did you think you were going to do when you were an undergraduate student?
Undergrad. So, you know, I was at Cambridge and I did economics as my degree. I have to say I pursued a degree in economics because that was my strongest subject at school. But at university, I was almost the complete opposite of what I was when I was at school. So taking it a bit further back, just for some of that context, Jeremy, I went to boarding school. So I was born in the UK, lived there till I was 7. And then my parents moved to Hong Kong. And when we went to Hong Kong, I was at a day school there, but never really fit in. And so when an opportunity came up to go to boarding school, to my parents' surprise, I leaped at the chance. I said I wanted to go to boarding school. I was only 10 years old. And they shipped me off. They're more than happy to, because they had 3 boys and having one less certainly made the household a lot more palatable to them. But yeah, the funny thing that happened when I was at boarding school, I switched from someone who was completely undisciplined and not particularly hardworking to a complete academic. I was at a small prep school called Caldecott in the outskirts of London, and I threw myself into study. I cannot explain why, but all I did was study, so much so that when the tutor did my first report, wrote to my parents, he said that he thinks that Adrian has a problem of having spent too much time just trying to study for tests and do this and do that, and literally ended with an anecdote of all work and no play makes Jack a really dull boy. But, you know, I think if I think back to maybe one potential trigger back then was in the dining room, there are these kind of boards in the dining room with students' names on it. And I remember asking the tutor, because all the students were assigned a tutor back then, why these kids had their names on them. And he said that, well, these are students who were at Caldecott and eventually got into Oxbridge. And not really knowing what Oxbridge was or what those universities stood for, I said, oh, it'd be nice to get in there one day. And he literally challenged me, said, well, actually, that's very difficult. I think it's highly unlikely that you would get in. And that as a trigger somehow set in my mind, I would try and aim for that many years later. And so that kind of set me forth on being studying really hard, trying to differentiate myself through academics. I did manage to get into a school called Harrow after that. And while I had to apply for the scholarship exam, I didn't get it. And I doubled down on my studies and ended up being able to stream into a class that allowed me, because they didn't let everyone apply, but allowed me to apply to Oxbridge. And then it was during that time in my fifth form that they said, well, if you'd like to maximize your chances, apply to Cambridge, because all the other classmates in your economics class, which there were five students, four of them applying to Oxford. And so that's how we had literally had decided on Cambridge. But you know, what I was like in Cambridge then completely flipped 180. And I wonder, you know, was it because, you see, I'd taken a gap year. I was slightly young for my year group. So I'd taken a gap year before going to Cambridge. And I spent a lot of that time in China, initially to study, but later to travel. And I spent 8 weeks backpacking across rural China that summer before going to university. And it opened my eyes to how big the world was and how much of a bubble I had grown up in. Literally, I remember one of my formative moments was we're in Lhasa. We flew into Lhasa and we were going to go to Base Camp Everest. This is in 1998, right? So quite some time back. And no mobile phone. My parents literally could not contact me. It's not like today. And we were hiking towards one of these monasteries and a member of our group had thrown this empty can of some tuna or some food into a bin, and it was just rushed upon by all these kids who obviously homeless and were migrant children and were hungry. Kid stuck his hand in and cut his hand, and it was bleeding. And so shocked, we went into help, used our first aid kit and everything. But something there had triggered me ultimately to feel strongly that in the future I would go back to an emerging market. I was thinking it'd be China at that time, and that I would hopefully get involved in something that could leverage technology to create much greater social and economic impact to people and provide them with greater opportunities. And you know, how that manifested later when I went back to university, I actually did a lot of things outside of my academics. I was involved in a number of societies, and there was a society then called the Industrial Society, who interfaced with corporates. I tried to start a couple of companies. We had tried to build an alumni network for students in universities across universities, but initially at Cambridge. And it revolved around sharing of essays on an online platform. We promptly got shut down by the university for plagiarism within the first week of operation. But you know, one of the other things we'd also did was set up a society that would run an annual ball and collect donations from students and give back for education in China. So I had ended up in university spending a lot of my time in trying to form ideas, form teams, create opportunity to learn as a leader, as a team member, to create some sort of change, to create some sort of impact. And I think that's one of the things I got most out of my university experience, as well as, thankfully, I scraped by a 2-1 and got my first job.
And it's interesting because your first job was in the finance industry. So how did you decide on that?
You know, it's funny, I didn't even plan on that. So in my second year, I found that I was probably woefully behind some of my classmates who'd done applications for internships and so on and so forth. What I'd ended up doing was I applied for a JP Morgan entrepreneurship competition. The idea was that you would get a PowerPoint, you'd pitch an idea, get ranked, and you'd win a prize of some sorts. It was money. So what I did is I actually created a business plan for a company. I think it was called Events. And it looks a little bit like, you know, the one where you can organize events and so on Eventbrite.
Oh, Eventbrite. Yeah.
Yeah. So this was back in 2000. I don't know if Eventbrite was around by then. I don't, maybe not, but it was pretty early and they liked the idea. So they said, well done, you've won. Here's a second place. Here's a couple of £1,000. And by the way, you're going to get an internship as well.
Wow.
The couple of £1,000 was fantastic. Yeah. And the internship was fantastic. It's something to do. So I had a great time in the internship and they made me a job offer. And that's how I ended up taking a place in JP Morgan. as my first job.
Amazing. And what was your experience? Because, you know, investment banking as an analyst back in the 2000s, it was a common-ish job, but also not a popular job. So what was the experience?
Yeah. So during the internship, we got that kind of full enamor of investment banking, the high lifestyle and so on. But when I got my job, when I entered, it was in 2001. And I remember very clearly that point of entry because I started, I think it was a week just after 9/11. So if you can recall back then, you know, basically the world essentially tipped into recession and fear. Obviously the atmosphere was completely different. I went into the FIG team, The Financial Institutions Group was a somewhat of a specialist team in corporate finance. And it was just very well known to be a team that did a lot of work. So I'd say that investment banking as a first job was also pretty formative in terms of my experience, because it literally showed me how hard a human could work on something, you know, by pulling, you know, all-nighters and days just living in the office to create PowerPoints, to pull deals and so on. I think several things. Like one, just that sheer amount of hard work, it kind of came to me at some point after a couple of years. I'm going to work this hard. I'd like to work on something that I truly believe in and I'm passionate about, and maybe I can accrue some equity in. I think the second thing, though, was just the incredible attention to detail and the quality of presentation that was important in being able to be a successful investment banker. And I think that level of analysis, see the hard training, but also the soft skills of communication, learning how to set yourself apart in an incredibly competitive environment as well. These were all things that I think really helped form my approach to working later, even as an entrepreneur. So I'm very thankful for that experience. I had some great mentors who had taught me that time. But yeah, I spent about 2.5 years there before applying to do my MBA.
And that's interesting because you went on to rotate into China actually as a geography, right? You were at Pepsi, eventually became a founder. But what was your thinking around that?
Yeah, so how that came about. So after 2.5 years in banking, I initially thought, well, first I want to get to Asia. And the market was very bad then. So even an internal transfer to Asia was impossible. Yeah, I wanted to go to Hong Kong. And that's what led me to think, well, why don't I do a MBA to try and transition my career. I applied to two schools, Harvard and Stanford. I was unfortunately only waitlisted at Harvard, but as I got a place at Stanford, I obviously leaped at that opportunity to go there. Now, similar to Harvard, when you apply to Stanford, you have to write these essays, really force some introspection about what matters to you. At least the two Stanford essays are what matters most to you, why, and how do you want to use your MBA, what do you want to do with it. And I remember clearly spending, you know, during the summer when I was still investment banking, many weekends in a row just trying to think about my collective experiences and what I wanted to do with my life. And one of the things that really came back to me was that experience in China that I had spoken about. And, you know, I felt that if I could kind of map out my route, my plan, I wanted to go to get an MBA, maybe become a consultant, learn how businesses happen. From there, start a company, be successful in building a business in technology. And from there, at a later point, be able to apply experience and also the capital that we've made and to invest in other entrepreneurs to create a leveraged impact. Now, some of the defining parts of my plan were that I wanted to go to an emerging market. Again, I thought it was China at the time because of the sheer size of China. And I felt that being ethnically Chinese, I would have some the roots there would help me be successful in that market. I felt strongly that technology, especially internet as a tool, would be something that would be not just scalable, but would be able to have wide-ranging impact. So those were the two of the kind of defining attributes of things that I wanted to go for in the future. So anyway, when I was at Stanford, I remember taking a lot of the entrepreneurial classes. And at one point, however, I spoke to a classmate who was in the year above me. He was a successful entrepreneur. He built a couple of companies even before school. And I told him, look, I want to start something. I think it's in language training. Actually, at the point in time, it was smart flashcards on the internet to help people learn Mandarin characters. And so I spoke to him about it. And he said, look, you're like most of the MBA students, right? They keep on thinking about the, especially the MBA students that come from corporate finance or other disciplines that are not entrepreneurial. You keep on thinking about building a business. You write endless business plans, but you've never sold anything and you've never made anything, right? You make it and sell it, and then you're going to be on the path of being an entrepreneur. I thought that was so insightful, right? So I literally went back to my study room, and I searched online for online flashcards. And I narrowed it down to a handful, three, and emailed. Back at that time, people was like the webmaster. So I emailed the webmaster, and it turned out that the one that I liked the most, it was an undergrad, a student at Stanford. And he said, look, I've always wanted to start a company after school. Let's meet up. And he was literally living down the road from me. And that was in towards the tail of my first year. So to cut a fairly long story short, essentially, in my second year, we spent a lot of my classes and time together working on this business plan. Actually changed the whole thing around from teaching Westerners or teaching people Mandarin using digital flashcards to actually a concept of applying virtual call center technology to deliver live on-demand English training to students in China. And now that we had that as the clear opportunity, as we built our conviction, by the time we graduated, we were so certain this is what we wanted to do. And that's how we ended up going off to China. The Pepsi internship was in between my first and second year because I didn't get accepted for any of the consulting jobs. And so somehow Pepsi said, look, we'll give you your leadership training kind of internship. So I went for that, but it was, you know, just a few weeks based in Hong Kong. You know, they did make me a job offer. Actually, that was one of the first tests of whether I would really go on and start my first company and be an entrepreneur. They made me quite an attractive job offer to be in their leadership training program or management training program. And I remember saying, look, I want to start a company. I've spent a lot of time working on it. I think there's a lot of potential. And they literally came back saying, well, how about this? We'll give you a sign-on offer. And when you've done your company thing, you can come and join us. And I was thinking, that's literally saying, I'm going to go do this. And of course, I'm going to fail and drop out because I'm going to come back to you after a couple of years. But you know, when I was at Pepsi and he said, if you ever want to come back, you can always come back. But if you don't go and do this now, you always regret what would have happened if you had gone and built this company. So upon graduation, Jonathan, my co-founder and I, we literally got on the plane, went to China after we'd raised a small amount of seed financing and started building our business. And it was, I think it was just one of the most exciting, one of the most formative things I've done in my career.
I mean, that's an amazing journey as well. Obviously, not just the Stanford MBA, but also discovering that just the market, but also discovering that you want to be an entrepreneur. It's interesting because both of us were actually in Beijing at the same time. I was in 2008.
Really?
I was in Tsinghua in Beijing. 2009,
down the road from you, Huatian Jiayuan.
Yeah, so very close. And then 2009, I was working at Ivy Schools, which was also an education tech startup. I'm sure you remember. So we're actually not that far from each other, actually. So we were in the same area.
We were in the same industry and we're in the same area. Imagine that.
So yeah, very, you know, because we were also doing like, you know, the English and bilingual instruction, of course, for preschoolers rather than for adults. But yeah, you know, well, who knew we were in the same zone, hanging out, probably eating at the same...
Potentially.
Air quality, probably, definitely. We were definitely breathing the same air.
It was actually pretty good in 2008. It got progressively worse from there. Yeah,
I know. It was a wonderful time during the Olympics. Perfect air for that time period. So what was your experience, you know, building? Obviously, it was a lot of firsts for you. So kind of like your full job experience in China, your first entrepreneurial experience, and obviously your first education tech experience as well. So lots of new things for you. What was that experience like?
I mean, certainly it was full of challenges and absolutely a lot of learning. There were, as you point out, a lot of firsts. Back then, when we arrived in China in 2006, we were the first team, my co-founder as the CTO, was the first team to bring in a coding language called Ruby on Rails to China.
It is legit, right?
And you can imagine we were so there was a well-known, a proven business in the US, a company called LiveOps, right? And what they had pioneered was this technology that could connect people working from home in the US to provide call center services. And because they lived in the US, they, again, more cultural context, even though they were per unit more expensive than, say, outsourcing to the Philippines or India, they were on a conversion basis cheaper than outsourcing because just the people on the other end of the phone would report higher satisfaction, higher conversion rates, right? So our concept, so we had actually at Stanford, I got introduced to the CEO at the time. And he said, look, initially with the idea of could we use this call center to help with English training to students in China? And he literally said, it's a great idea, it would work, but you shouldn't use what I have. You should start a company and I'll invest in you to go and do this. So we were fortunate to have this chap, Bill Trenchard, as an investor. And he helped us map out how we would build this call center, virtual call center in the US, and connect these live trainers to students in China. But again, back then, remember in 2006, it was when the first iPhone was launched. So it was actually very tricky to get all the parts of the technology right, where you had an interactive classroom that was PC-based on a desktop. You had to terminate the voice via typically a fixed-line phone. So you had to have a phone or, you know, a mobile phone, a cellular phone on staff to speak to the teacher. And of course, the internet quality, it was not as strong as it is today, right? Certainly, it wasn't a pure mobile experience. I remember starting out where we were in Udaoko, right? So just opposite Beijing Language School, Tsinghua, you know, Beidao, all these places. And we would run in, we'd go to the school and offer free live English training courses, sessions to students, bring them to the internet cafe, and then set them up on computers and then connect them to these trainers in the US. And you know, I think that, so the product worked incredibly well, meaning that with the practice that people got, they really improved their conversational and oral English skills, which really is the issue because these students had studied English for many years and were good at written tests and good at reading too, but they just could not express themselves and can converse. And so while the product was good and people were willing to pay money and were able to make money on it, it was still tough to convert a broader audience. So a lot of learnings from this experience. I think, you know, one was that while we had a great product, it was early to market, right? You know, this company we built in 06, we eventually sold the company in 2010. It wouldn't be until a couple of years, I think, later that VIP Kit started to get big and ultimately became a unicorn, right, in this live English training space. Of course, then the Chinese government shut down English training or private education, and then the company couldn't continue either. So timing is an incredibly important thing. But you know, I would also say that product innovation, while there are certain markets that is kind of the core of tech, especially in Silicon Valley and these days in China as well. In emerging markets, I learned that you could create immense value from building businesses which weren't, say, on the cutting edge of innovation, but rather where you could take proven business models, proven products, and bring them into the market. And so that was a second pretty important lesson. I would say the third, which is, you know, a question of management. We did raise a Series A round of financing, which was very tough because we went several months without money before we got that in. But when we got it in and we were trying to use the money to accelerate growth, particularly in a product which was, again, on kind of the early part of the adoption curve, we made mistakes in where we spent the money. In fact, we couldn't get the traction. So we actually thought, well, why don't we take the entire infrastructure that we have, which is this kind of online learning system, and teach people around the world Chinese and build the entire same product again, but for teaching Chinese, not English. You know, that turned out to be a costly mistake because, again, it was early for product adoption, online learning in China, it was early for people wanting to learn Mandarin around the rest of the world as well. And, you know, we ended up spending a good portion of our capital on there and ended up having to, one of the really difficult decisions we did, having to close down that entire department, which made up half the company at one point. And then ultimately really realizing where we ultimately got traction, where we could really truly monetize and start to scale revenues, was when we zeroed in and focused on the singular customer. And at that point, it was a customer who is an IELTS student. The kind of the IELTS exam required an oral examination, which was a live interview with an examiner. And this was what many students were failing at to get the top tier marks in order to go abroad to study or go abroad to become nurses or whatever, what have you. And you know, they were willing to pay top prices to have this training, and the product would really improve their English. But you know, by then, by the time we'd actually found that real fit, we were running low on runway. And in the end, we had to end up selling the technology and the business.
I mean, like you said, you were very early. You know, I remember at the time, right, 2006, 2007, 2008, that was the start of the education tech. You can call it wave. I was going to say boom, I would say, definitely. I think it's an aspect of it in China. But that was also the first wave of startups that, you know, the liberalization of the business laws and stuff like that. And like you said, it's been quite crazy to see the shift of that regulatory environment 10, a dozen years down the road. But it's definitely fascinating here about the entrepreneurship journey. And what's interesting is that you went on to work at Rocket Internet after that as a managing director. So how did that come about?
So I was working on my earnout at that last company once we were acquired. And I was actually initially approached by a recruiter at Rocket. Well, actually, it wasn't Rocket Internet at the time. So Rocket Internet, the Sandler brothers had sold their company City Deals to Groupon, and they became the international arm of Groupon. And so I was contacted by a Galpeng, basically the China Groupon, to go join their team in China. I remember walking in and seeing literally they'd grown from zero to 3,000 people in half a year and just thinking, oh my God, this thing is a beast. But it wasn't appealing to me. Over that time, actually, I was really turning over my mind to start another company. I'd heard about Airbnb. I'd seen kind of the rise of all the apartments and empty apartments in China. I'd seen in the listing sites how people were trying to rent out apartments. And I was thinking there was a good opportunity to do something here. And as it turned out, obviously Rocket had cloned something like Airbnb in Germany, and they wanted to do the same thing in China. So they'd started a company called Airizu, and they were looking for a CEO of that business. And yeah, they told me, look, you can come in. We've already funded the business. We've got a product. You need to take it to scale it now. And I thought that was incredibly interesting. So Oliver Sandler flew in. I spent half a day with him. He said, look, you're in. You're going to be CEO. And that's how I started it, working with what later became Rocket Internet. And look, I would say that was a really interesting experience because it was almost like the counterbalance to my experience in building my first company, right? Where it was tough to get a product market fit. It was almost instant that this was the right product for the right time. Remember, within the first 6 months of us commercializing and getting the product off the ground, we booked something like 250,000 nights through the platform just because it really solved the need so clearly, and it took away from all the other listing sites. Of course, around in China at that time, as you've probably seen yourself, once people hit on an interesting idea, yeah, just the competition is so fierce. While we had capital, we were in no way funded in the same way as some of these pure play new companies were funded by deep pockets and capital. And of course, all the traditional listing players like Gan Xiwang and so on, they also went after this space. In fact, the level of competition that I'd observed there, I don't think I've ever seen it elsewhere. For example, we saw a web design company that literally had copied our entire site and was selling our the content and the site. So anyone who wanted to start an Airbnb type of company for a few thousand renminbi, right? So like, here's 20,000 renminbi. You can go start your own company. It was so blatant, right? And then employees, team members were being poached. Literally, there was a practice of poaching and firing. You'd poach someone, you'd maybe double their salary, and then they'd come over to the new company for a few months, and then they would get rid of them, right? And that would obviously be hugely disruptive, right? So just there was so much competition that, to me, competing at levels which maybe I was not particularly comfortable in building a business operating like that, gave me my first sense that maybe my long-term future was not going to be in China. We did actually end up getting both term sheets for investment and an acquisition offer of the company, which the Rocket, which was the majority owner of the business, did not agree to the valuation. Even we would have made a pretty interesting multiple off their invested capital. But after that particular experience, I had decided to try and then to look at different markets. So backtracking a bit, what happened was around the time I sold my first company, I met a lady who's now my wife, and she's from Indonesia. Actually, we were both members of this organization called EO, Entrepreneurs Organization. Oh. I'd been the chapter president at the time. She was on the board for Indonesia, and she was visiting Beijing for her brother's graduation, because her brother had studied at Tsinghua for the international MBA. And so got to know her, and we started to date, and I visited her in Jakarta. And that was my first trip to Indonesia, late 2010. And I thought it was a fascinating country when I first went there. But it wasn't until the second trip I came down to, that was 2011 now, came again to Indonesia, Jakarta. And I remember going to, I think, what was the very first Tech in Asia conference in Jakarta, probably like less than 100 people at this conference. And I'd met with Ferry at Traveloka, you know, I can't remember if I saw William there, but it suddenly dawned on me that here was this massive market that was ripe for digital disruption, that would go through the same type of digitization that China went through. And I could bring all that experience and everything that I'd seen from China to Indonesia. And so by 2012, decided, look, had enough China, I'm going to come to Indonesia and make this my home. And yep, thankfully, the relationship worked out because Vanessa and I, we ended up getting married and moved to Jakarta.
Wow, that was a big bet. I mean, you made multiple geography bets, but I guess a relationship bet is the paid off the best, I'll say, for sure.
Yes. Yes, that's right.
That's interesting, right? Because you went off to build in Indonesia. And what's interesting is that you chose to also rotate into kind of like investing as well. So both a geographic shift, but also a role shift in many ways. So what was your thinking back then in setting up Convergence Ventures?
Yeah. So if, you know, going back to that initial plan, could call it a life plan when I applied to Stanford, you know, I had in my mind to always be an investor of sorts. You know, I'd thought less from a perspective of being a financial investor, more of being an active investor where I could help entrepreneurs, hopefully from lessons learned, but resources as well as capital. And my break into venture came when I was introduced through one of my classmates who was a venture capitalist in the US to one of the large conglomerates in Indonesia. And when we met, I told basically this principle that I saw huge potential in the digitization of Indonesia's economy. And in particular, for this conglomerate, where a lot of their main businesses were in media and free-to-air television, they could see that internet represented quite a significant threat to the long-term sustainability of their business. And so naturally, they were also interested to learn more and to be an active investor in these companies in order to spot opportunities and figure out how to evolve their business over time. So that conversation led to them anchoring a good portion of what would become my first fund, Convergence Ventures. I went back to China, tapped into some of my investor network there and raised the rest of the capital. And so I started working on that in 2014, and it took us 2 full years to raise that first fund of $30 million. You know, we're thankful that investor initially helped get us into business. And we got on some good investments as well during that time, in particular around the fintech space. And I think maybe that those early days in FIG made me comfortable with looking at financial technologies. But really, of course, the market opportunity for fintech, given that such a large portion of Indonesia's population is underbanked, represented a huge opportunity. So we're early investors in companies like Injulo, Coinworks, IOConnect, a whole bunch of these PayFaz companies that we found in those days, 2016, 17. that we ended up backing.
Amazing. And these are very much, you know, kind of household names, at least in the, those who are in the know, especially in the tech world. You know, what's interesting is that you've always been early, I would say, right? I mean, you've been early to, say, China in the market, early to education tech as a vertical, and also, frankly, early to Indonesia as a market back in 2014. So I'm just curious, you're obviously seen a lot, and what do you think are some myths or misconceptions that people have about the Indonesia, I'll say, startup and venture capital market from your perspective? What do people get wrong from your perspective, or you find that you have to correct them fundamentally?
Yeah, so I would say the number one thing that I'm always told about or asked about when it comes to Indonesian tech is that Indonesia is so expensive. And I think, well, yes, naturally, some of the valuations of the businesses out here. So set aside 2021 when everything was valued. So we're just talking relatively compared to the rest of Southeast Asia. Yes, the valuations have been relatively higher, but I think it's simply reflective of the fact that the market opportunity here is so much larger. I think that we've seen now, one of the early theses we had when we built that first fund was Indonesia-centric. So it was Indonesia-first fund. We primarily invested in companies based in Indonesia and potentially could go, or potentially companies that would expand from elsewhere into Indonesia. The other thing was that when we looked at the opportunity set of investments, again, this particular era, again, looking at kind of my experience in China, where a lot of the Chinese initial early companies were copied to China. So these are proven business models that went into China. The same thing happened in India, and I believe the same thing would happen to Indonesia. Now, if you look at these types of business models, they tend to be the ones which are not so product-driven, but more execution-driven, which requires offline operations. To be able to expand such companies multi-country is actually very expensive and very difficult to do. And so I did not believe so much in the regional nature of building businesses in Southeast Asia, more just in kind of the Indonesia market opportunity in of itself. So that kind of translates to two things. So one, because that market opportunity is so big, you know, I often have to tell people, well, things may be slightly more expensive here because it's reflective of that. But you know, actually, it's justified because you can build these businesses into, say, billion-dollar valuation businesses, given that market size. I think on the extreme side, the other thing is that there is a clear difference between if you're, say, regional or even global, looking at investments in Indonesia. You're looking at something at the, really at the peak, right? Where there are a select few companies who've gone to scale where they're large enough and well-known enough that you would come to you and have a look at. And of course, those are going to be the most expensive as well, because those are the fewest number of companies and now you've got the most number of investors who get to see those, right? But if you look more grassroots, you can certainly find companies, even compared regionally, they won't be perceived as expensive. And I think even more so now in this part of the cycle, where we're no longer in that 2021 bubble, where we're actually very much kind of post-bubble in the aftermath, where overall general sentiment towards these technology businesses and so on, it is very low. You can find some very attractively priced businesses now. And you're not even just talking about lower multiples. You're talking about businesses which you can price on earnings, on EBITDA, for example, because there is a new class of businesses which have been born in this era, which have been bootstrapped, which have had huge discipline towards unit economics and have built businesses which are ready to scale because now the product works and they can make money. And now you can replicate and scale those operations in that way. These are not businesses which are expensive. So, yeah, I think those are a couple of things that sometimes I'm trying to correct people on.
I think it's definitely true that Indonesia has the market size. And I think the market, as a result, will reward companies that are much more disciplined in execution that are focused on Indonesia as a market. I think one criticism that has been said or feedback is that the concern is that the return profile of such businesses may look closer to like small cap private equity returns versus, I think, the classic definition of venture capital. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, no, I think that's a great observation. Look, I think, so first, I would say that I would separate out, there are, in my view, for Indonesia, there are two eras. There's the era of the pure play internet business. And that was very much the kind of 2010 to 2020, 2021. That era is more or less played out. But I would say that you certainly could get venture returns from that era. You're investing, say, in that first half, 2010 to 2015 or so. You're finding businesses which are sub 10 million pre-money, and they could scale to, say, a $1 billion outcome. In fact, one of the things I try and remind people when I see them is that when we were building the first fund, we were underwriting for potential $1 billion businesses. And what happened? Because of the run-up, companies like Tokopedia, Gojek, Grab, they became multi, not even deca billions, right? So you had like $40 billion companies that were created. So we went way past what we had originally underwritten for. And I think it was some of the return dilution has actually been a function of oversupply of capital versus the market, because these companies got flooded with so much capital. They kind of pursued growth for growth's sake. It caused further dilution, and therefore people didn't make the types of returns. But Ken, for example, even now, when Gojek or GoTo has fallen so much, it's still a multi-billion dollar business right now, today. If they had, would they have needed all that capital to get to where they are today? Probably not, I think. But you know, if you were an early investor at sub 10 million pre, you'd probably still make a decent venture. But anyway, so I think a lot of those business models are done in that era. And now we're looking to the next era. And for that, I concur with you. I think that there are increasing opportunities here now in this market where the returns will look a lot more like kind of this small cap or mid cap private equity. But nonetheless, I think they're fascinating because you're talking about a lot of real economy businesses that are going to get digitally transformed or adopt technologies in ways that is going to help them scale faster, help them reduce cost, and become more efficient and effective businesses as a whole. And you know, this could be everything from a retailer selling online to, for example, a business incorporating generative AI technologies to better target their customers or to reduce even just customer service costs. And these can have great, great impact on underlying margins and therefore the profitability of businesses. Now, the key for these businesses, therefore, is also how you come in, right? You can't be coming in and saying, I'm going to go pay 3-4 times revenue on these businesses and expect to make a return. So, you know, in this category, and not just this kind of era, but in this category, there needs to be a lot more discipline in how you're underwriting those businesses and valuing those businesses. And when you look at businesses which actually have cash flows, then there's more to work with as well. But nonetheless, it still represents a great opportunity. And especially when you think about the next 10 years, you intersect with the digital transformation of these with an inflection point of the Indonesian consumer, where if we're growing at 5.5% per year, your Indonesian GDP per capita is going to cross $10,000 per person within the coming decade. And that's going to unlock a lot of disposable income for the economy. And Indonesians being, I think one of the things I've observed, I think is a cultural nuance, is that Indonesians tend to consume a lot. It's much more a consumption economy versus a savings economy. That's, you know, as opposed to say India or China. And therefore, you know, I think that there's going to be a lot of potential here.
Amazing. On that note, could you share about a time that you personally have been brave?
Yeah. So I would say, when would you know you're brave? I suppose when you feel like there's some fear, right? When there's some fear there. And I've gone to a lot of, you know, different countries where I've been driven so much by conviction and belief in the opportunity, whether it's going to China or coming to Indonesia. I would say I actually didn't feel fear there. I just was so engrossed with the potential and the opportunity and the excitement to get somewhere early and to create something. So I probably wouldn't talk about that. But you know, as you know, I'm not particularly athletic as a person. I'm not on a big build or anything, but I have spent a fair bit of time in endurance sports. You know, I would say that when I decided, you know, after I'd learned about the Ironman triathlon, and something in my mind said, look, you know, do you want to challenge yourself and really want to do this? You know, what is an Ironman triathlon? It's a triathlon. It's the longest single day endurance event. You do a swim of 4 kilometers, you cycle for 180 kilometers, and then you finish with a marathon, 42 kilometers, and you have to finish it within 17 hours. And, you know, I remember when I signed up for my race in 2013, I just moved to Indonesia in 2012. The commitment of time, of resources, and the support you need to elicit from people around you to go and do this, there was a certain amount of fear in being able to commit fully to be able to do it without knowing, even if you put in the time, whether you finish it, because it's just such a long event. But, you know, I'm incredibly thankful that the training went well. I put in a lot of time. I think they were doing it one point over 10 hours of training a week to go and do this. My family was with me when I crossed the finish line. I think I did it in just 13 hours and 1 minute or something. But, you know, it really gave me a sense of a reinforcement where if you put your mind to something and you set aside the time and you put in the hard work, you can really control that outcome. And I think that in the toughest situations is something that I can go back to, whether it's professional, whether it's personal, whether it's family or whatever else. That gives hope. If you kind of put everything in, then you should have a really good shot at getting what you want out of it.
Wow. That feels like also a perfect metaphor to describe, I think, your entire career as well, in terms of endurance and control around the variables for the outcome. On that note, I'd love to summarize the 3 big takeaways I got from this conversation. First of all, thank you so much for sharing about your early childhood, about your education, and how you were inspired by someone telling you that it's unlikely for you to go to Oxbridge and saying, hey, you know, I guess I could get my name up on that wall. And I think it was really inspiring to hear about your early decisions about the schooling that you were going to go for, but also the career choices and exploration and interests that inspire you in the early days. Secondly, thanks so much for sharing about your time in China and also choosing to be an entrepreneur after your Stanford MBA. I thought it was a fascinating and very real insight into how you thought about it, but also how you size the risk and how you are so excited about the opportunity to build and explore the market, but also explore the different product market fit iterations about what it means to be a founder. Lastly, thanks so much for sharing about Indonesia. I think it was a very quick, but also succinct way to describe, I think, the questions that people have and what they need to learn about Southeast Asia and Indonesia, but also some thoughtfulness around, like you said, the discipline needed on the investing side in terms of pricing and judgment. But also, I think, the execution discipline needed by founders to build out the next set of opportunities in Indonesia. On that note, thank you so much, Adrian, for sharing.
Thank you, Jeremy, so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to Brave. If you enjoyed this episode, please share the podcast with your friends and colleagues. We would also appreciate you leaving a rating or review. Head over to www.bravesea.com for member content, resources, and community. Stay well and stay brave.